Oh, there we go. Great. So hello, welcome everybody. Come on in. There's plenty of room. Hello and welcome to Developing Future-Focused On-Premises Solutions for SharePoint. My name is Bob German. I'm thrilled to be here. I guess I should say I'm super excited to be here because I think super excited is kind of the catchphrase for the conference this year. I am super excited. I work for a company called Blue Metal Architects, and I'm really excited because this is the, I believe, the only on-premises focused development session at the SharePoint conference. And I was thrilled to hear at the developer keynote that on-prem is alive and well, and that even farm solutions are alive and well, although I'm going to try to convince you that there is a better way. And not because Microsoft paid me to do that, because they didn't, but because, well, we'll get into it, because there's some sort of limitations and issues with the farm solutions that we've been building probably since 2003. And it doesn't really have to be that way. Fundamentally, SharePoint development today is like MS-DOS development was back in the day. It's a lot like Windows 3.1 development. Now, I'm not talking about tools or languages here. I'm talking about the fact that in those days, in those bad old days, code would run and it could completely wipe out your machine. And SharePoint development has been like that since 2003, when they introduced the ability to develop .NET code for SharePoint. Your SharePoint application code is omnipotent. It can do absolutely anything. One forgotten dispose of an SP site object, one too many run with elevated privileges, can circumvent security, can bring your farm to its knees. And as a result, this does not play well in multi-tenant environments, and I'm talking about on-premises here. I work for a consulting company, and we have a lot of clients who get really, really nervous when we give them code to install into the global assembly cache on all their web servers, and we just say, don't worry, it won't hurt anything. Right? Have you ever had that experience? There's another thing, which is that developers need to have full SharePoint on their development machines. Right? And you can always tell the SharePoint developers because they've got the big backpacks, right? And they just came back from the chiropractor. They're a little bit hunched over from carrying these huge machines. 24 gigs is the recommended amount of RAM to give your SharePoint development machine if you turn on all the features in an all-in-one deployment. And I'm happy to say that this isn't true for all the demos today, but for the new app model, I'm actually able to build apps on my little tablet, my little Windows 8 tablet. This tablet easily meets the minimum configuration for Visual Studio. It's a little bit small to see, but it works. And so this can greatly lighten your load as a SharePoint developer. And to celebrate the unshackling of SharePoint developers everywhere from these huge laptops, at the end of the talk, I'm going to give away one of these Dell Venue8 Pro tablets. And so you can download the code. All the code I'm going to show is downloadable. I'll have links at the end. You can download a trial edition of Visual Studio. If you win the tablet, you'll have everything you need to do those demos yourself. So pretty amazing stuff. But what I really want to talk about is kind of the transition. How do we get there, and why do we get there, and what's the real world? The app model is still maturing, and I'm going to talk more about that. And the reality is that not everybody's on the new version of SharePoint to even do the new app development. So let's start by talking a little bit about isolation. In the bad old days, as I said, MS-DOS, and this is where SharePoint Farm Solutions are now, you had no isolation at all. Then we had Windows NT, and some of the gnashing of teeth and kind of upset on the part of SharePoint developers that I've heard recently is actually a lot like what I heard when we went from Windows 3.1 or Windows 95 to Windows NT. And all of a sudden, there was a real operating system that was going to enforce real rules and restrict what your application could do. And it seemed inconvenient at the time, but we learned a new way. And looking back on it, I hope you would agree with me that it was worth it. It was worth it to live within, to kind of stay within the lines, to have a system that didn't get slower every time you installed a new app, that didn't get flakier and weirder every time you installed a new app. But you know what? if you've ever seen, ever had that little pop-up that says on your Windows machine that says, oh, your application wants to run with elevated privileges, wants to run as administrator. You ever get that? User access control? That points out that this type of isolation was not complete. It really didn't fully do the job. And the problem with that little prompt is, one problem is the non-technical users, they've just learned to click yes and not ask any questions, which sort of defeats the purpose. And even a technical person, how do you really know whether you should click yes? I just downloaded a greeting card app, and it wants to run as administrator. Should I allow it? Why does it need that permission, right? Now look at your phone. When you install an app on your phone, what happens? Well, it comes up when you install it and says, this app wants access to your contacts list and your location. So you can give it very granular access to what it needs. And you can actually use some logic. Oh, gosh, it's a greeting card application. No, I don't think it really needs access to my contacts list. So no. Or maybe yes, it does, right? So you can make a much more informed decision. The new app model that the SharePoint folks have rolled out actually uses that full level of isolation. So not only do you have process memory isolation, you have app-based permission, so the application can have its own permission to do things. And you also have storage isolation, which means that when you take away the app, it doesn't leave any little things, any little tidbits behind for you. So the whole idea here really is to start thinking outside the box. The way that this new app model works is that all of your code runs outside of SharePoint, and this is a big shift. So instead of trying to protect SharePoint from code that's running inside of it, which they tried with the sandbox solutions and the user code service, and it didn't work very well, we now have the option of saying, you know what, we're just going to run the code outside of SharePoint and provide a very rich set of client APIs coming into SharePoint. And then we can provide the protection at those APIs. Your code, therefore, needs to run in the browser or in an external website and needs to use the client APIs. And this works on premises or in the cloud. Now, I would say to you that Microsoft has made it very clear that you're not going to be forced to go to Office 365 or the cloud, and that farm solutions will continue to work. And I think that's a good thing. I think that there's lots of good reasons to run on premises. And there's regulatory reasons and other reasons that, you know, you need to be able to control that, and that's awesome. But I would suggest that anyone running SharePoint on premises should be looking to Office 365 and trying to run their operation that tightly, okay? And to not have to stay up so that SharePoint administrator doesn't toss and turn all night wondering whether that application that they installed earlier in the day is going to bring the entire server down. So what we're doing as developers, if we start to adopt these new patterns, is we're actually going to make life easier for our on-premises SharePoint operations as well. So if we look at kind of the traditional way of doing things versus the modern way, the modern application sort of approach, is that, you know, traditionally we use the server APIs, now we start to use client APIs. Traditionally, code runs inside of SharePoint, now it runs outside. We deploy them differently, and yeah, this makes it possible for us to run in the cloud if we want to, and to have more granular permission. So what I'd like to show you today is some patterns that you can use to get your code running outside of SharePoint on premises, and you know what, you have more options on premises, and you can do this even with older versions of SharePoint. Two out of the three demos will work on SharePoint 2010 equally as well as they run on 2013, and then later, unlike most of the farm solutions today, you can easily repackage them into the app model. So you can get started on app model style development even on SharePoint 2010. To sort of review the app model quickly, the way that this works is that you install your app into what's called the host web. And then the host web, in the case of a SharePoint hosted app, creates this thing called the app web, which is a child site that has a funny URL. And that's for the isolation. I'll talk about that in a minute. And then all of your code just gets deployed to the app web, but it actually runs in the browser. In the case of a provider or auto-hosted app, you also add an external website that's going to run that code. The way that the isolation works is It actually uses this feature that's been in web browsers for many years called same origin policy, which essentially says if I am at my cute kitty website, no offense to anyone who likes kitties, if I'm at my cute kitty website and I'm also at my banking website, that the kitty shouldn't be able to empty my bank account. Right? And so that kind of protection has been around for a long time, and Microsoft has exploited that by going ahead and giving different URLs to the app web and to the external application so that you can't just reach into SharePoint randomly. If you want to reach in, you have to use a cross-domain library from JavaScript, or you have to use OAuth, the Open Authorization Protocol, to reach in from an external site, and that's how they can enforce the granular permissions. We're not going to get all those benefits if we run outside of the app model, but we can start to at least make it easier for that to happen. So this is sort of my good, bad, and ugly slide for the app model. The app model has all these advantages, most of which I've already talked about. You get the isolation, it cleans up the mess, because that child, one of the nice things about that child site is when you take away your app, you delete the child site, or SharePoint deletes the child site, and everything that you've created gets cleaned up pretty much that way. It'll also clean up old web parts off the pages so you don't have those funny errors that happen if you uninstall it. There are some challenges, however. It's sort of a V1 product. So there's some things that you can't really do very easily. It's hard to change the host web page and to do branding. You can do it with procedural code, but that would actually, you know, it's a lot more work than doing it the traditional way. So that's a little bit of a limitation. Auto-hosted apps are still in preview mode. Apps can't be provisioned into site templates, so if you have an app and you put it on a page and then you click Save Site as Template and then you create a site from that template, the app won't be there. So there's some things that are limitations, but I'm sure Microsoft is working through these things. And I'm glad to see that they're investing in more client APIs, because that's one of the differences, is that the server APIs can do more than the client. Well, they just announced that they've added a client-side API for creating a site collection. And I expect that they're going to continue to go through and fill in those APIs. But I think the biggest challenge of the app model today is that all the code that you've already built up would have to be completely rewritten in order to work in the app model. And that's really what this talk is all about. Working for a consulting company, I honestly could not, in good conscience, keep doing things the way I had always done them and pretend that nothing was changing. Yet most of our clients are still on SharePoint 2010. How many people in this room still have in their environment SharePoint 2010 or an earlier version? So there's a lot of this around, right? People don't just immediately change, and I don't think it's realistic to expect that. And yet to continue to do it the old way and pretend there's no change is also not a realistic assumption. So the idea is to start adopting the app model patterns even before you have the app model. Stop running code in the server and start running it in the browser. Stop using the server APIs and start using the client APIs. Stop designing solutions the old way and start building modern applications that are structured like apps. I would even go so far as to say, perhaps a little provocatively, that when you go out onto the expo floor and you look at all of the wonderful products that the exhibitors have, ask them if they run with Office 365, even if you have no intention of going there yourself. Why? Because if they say yes, or if it's at least on their roadmap, you know that they are also figuring out how to lighten their footprint on SharePoint, how to be more loosely coupled with SharePoint. And when you install that product, you will not have to wonder if their product is going to break your farm either, if it's the version that runs on Office 365. So fundamentally, pretend you're going to Office 365 even if you're not. There's really two good reasons I can think of. One is that Microsoft is investing in this heavily, so all new tooling and other APIs and things that come along are likely to be in this area. And secondly, your on-prem farms can enjoy the stability, ease of upgrade that Office 365 demands. And believe me, your administrators might not be in this room right now, but they will appreciate it. So I have a real-world scenario for you. I have a colleague who is here at the conference. Name is Julie Turner. She has a client, and this client is a large investment bank in the greater Boston area. And she put together this really cool solution, and we've She built it out here as an IT issues tracking, but it actually was not the IT department. It's another department. But the pattern here is that users from throughout this large organization fill out forms, a workflow kicks off, and then there's a team of half a dozen people who service these requests. And that was all working great, and what the customer wanted was, hey, could you please let us track these? We need to be able to track whether or not these requests are getting handled in a timely manner. We need it to be real time. We need to know what business units submitted the request. We need to know, you know, who's actually handling the most requests out of the team and all that kind of stuff. So that seemed fairly straightforward. All the data was in a SharePoint list. So the first option might have been to write a farm solution, but there was a 6-month approval process to get a farm solution installed inside of this investment bank. That's not unrealistic. When I worked for Microsoft for many years, a very common question I would get is, how do we deal with this? How do we vet code before we install it? And they had an answer for this, but it took a long time. And the business unit was not willing to wait. Sandbox, that was out. They had shut it off. And the code running in user code service is going to be deprecated, right? That's been announced. So that really wasn't an option. You might be sitting there thinking, well, what if I used Excel services and Power Pivot? That'd be kind of cool. They were running SharePoint 2010, so that was fine. But the problem with that is that it only refreshes once a day, and they wanted a real-time report. Now, if you know Julie, she's kind of a take-no-prisoners type of developer. Not much will stop her, so she proceeded to write the entire dashboard in a content editor web part. And here it is. So if you take a look at this, here's the site, and this is what all the little requests look like. And you can see that it's kind of hard to kind of grasp what's going on just by looking at all the little requests. Click on the dashboard, and you'll be able to see exactly what's going on. This is a content editor web part. She wrote the entire thing in JavaScript, jQuery, Knockout.js, and she used a package called HiCharts. And I should probably connect with the HiCharts people because they don't even know about this. We just bought the package and used it for the project. And the customer was thrilled. It's real time. It works. The IT department did not know or care that we did this because they're perfectly good with content editor web parts. The other cool thing is, when they are ready to go to SharePoint 2013, and Julie and I did a little bit of advanced work for them, the whole thing can become an app for SharePoint. So now here's the same code, and she got over 95% code reuse between the content editor web part and this SharePoint-hosted app. The first thing it does when you install it is it says, what do you trust? Do you trust this IT request dashboard? And the app wants permission to read items from a list. So we have to go in and select which list it is that we want the items from. And we can go ahead and trust that. There's the same dashboard now running as a SharePoint 2013 app. So very cool stuff. Now, unfortunately, I can't share this exact example with you because we don't own the code and it uses a third-party commercial product for the graphing, but I have a very, very similar example that I can show you where the code and details for how to build it and how it works are already posted up on the internet. So at the end, I'll have some I'll show you all of those examples. There's a question here. Knockout.js, jQuery, and then HiCharts was the name of the charting package, and we have some t-shirts for people who ask questions, so could we give I don't know if you could see who it was, but right there, thank you. Awesome, thank you, and keep the good questions coming. I appreciate it. So I'm going to show three demos. One is where we run our code in the browser. That's the same pattern that Julie used. The second is where we put the code in an external web server. And the third is where we run in the workflow manager, and that's only going to work in the new workflow model in SharePoint 2013. By the way, are you able to collect the names and stuff? Is that all happening? So I forgot to call out thank you to Sadie Van Buren, who is actually one of my colleagues here. She created the SharePoint maturity model, and she and Jonathan Ralton are actually going to go around and set up for the drawing later for the Dell tablet. Sorry, I sort of forgot that part. So it's important because we won't have time at the end to do this. So, okay, so let's go ahead and dig into these demos. So this first one is a site creation web part. So essentially, it's a simple little web part. And what this does is it lists and provisions child sites using a web template. So if you've ever gone in and had users creating websites in SharePoint, you'd realize that they never know which template to use. They can make a complete mess of matters. So here we have a web part that actually, again, is written inside of a content editor web part. And this is what it looks like in SharePoint 2010. It lists out the sites. And then if I click Create a Site, I can go ahead and fill in a little form and sort of future-proof my applications, put in a little description and a URL, and create the site. And in a second, it'll pop up, and it'll say my site was successfully created. It added it to the list. And there's my site. And it used a custom site template, which you can see because I just put our name and logo in there as a way of proving that it was a custom template. Same thing, once again, becomes a SharePoint 2013 app. Here it wants me to trust it, and I don't know if you can see it, but it says let it have full control of the site collection, which is a lot of control. But it needed that in order to do the create site functionality. Now this runs as a full page app, but it can also run in a web part. So I'll go ahead and show what that looks like. So there's my web part. And once again, I can come in here and create a site. Type in a description. And it will create my site. And again, this time I changed the color to show that it was a custom, one. So now if we look at the code, I'm going to start by just sort of showing the structure of the code. On the left, we have the SharePoint 2010 solution as it would look in Visual Studio. And on the right, we have the SharePoint 2013 version. So they're really kind of similar. They both have the script in app.js. And so let's sort of walk through. So they both have HTML and CSS, which made up the little table that you saw and the form that was filled out to create the site. That was 100% common code. Then we had to get the SharePoint context. Now this is the entire trick of the demo, really, is getting the SharePoint context is actually unique and different for the two solutions. In the case of the SharePoint 2010 version, it just gets the SharePoint context. Everybody know what the SharePoint context is? So when you're calling from the client side, you have to create this, you use the client object model. The way that it knows which SharePoint site you're on and what you're doing is through this thing called the SharePoint context. So in SharePoint 2010, there's only one context. It's for the actual site that you're running on. In SharePoint 2013, you're kind of juggling two contexts, one for the app web, one for the host web. So the app web context is just the local context, because that's where your code has been deployed to, your JavaScript code. And to get to the host web, you have to use this thing called the cross-domain library. And so that's just a few lines of code. It creates another SharePoint context object. Then when you want to talk to a list or a library or do something in the SharePoint site, you use the SharePoint context in order to get access to that. And I'll show you the code a little bit. I'm not going to show a whole lot of code here. It's a 300 level, so I figured I'd go a little bit light on the code. But as I said, all of it's downloadable afterwards. So basically, the code knows about both contexts. But in the 2010 case, appcontext.js just returns the same context twice. And in the 2013 version, it uses the cross-domain library to return the host context with all the security in place. Then the code that gets and displays the sites, that finds the web template and creates the child site, is all 100% common code. So let's take a look at that code. So here we are in the SharePoint 2010 solution, and I think that may be all that I have time to show. I don't know, I'm going to sort of pace myself today. But basically, this is my content editor web part. And the way I created this was I went into SharePoint and I added a content editor web part, type hello world, and then I exported it. And what it gave me was this DWP file. And then I took the DWP file and I edited out, took away hello world, and where there had been hello world, I put all of the code that I needed to make the site creation logic work. So here you can see that I've got my own little style sheet. I've got a div that's going to hold that list of sites. I've got the site creation form, which is normally hidden. And here's a table that shows that contains that form that they can fill in. Then the little link for if you want to bail out of the form, and then a little message that shows that it's creating the site. So the actual, now if you just drop this on the page, you're good to go. So this is actually packaged up as a sandbox solution, but it will work without the user code service having any quota. So a little note on this. If you turn off the user code service, you will not be able to do anything with the solutions gallery. For instance, click Save Site as Template and create a site from that template. You won't be able to do it because you won't be able to activate the site template, the web template, if the user code service is turned off. Unfortunately, Julie's client had done that, and she had to manually upload all the little pieces of script and paste into her content editor web part to make that work. The way they did it when I worked at Microsoft, they had some sites that didn't allow the user code service. They simply set the quota to zero, which meant that no user code can run, but you can do the declarative stuff. So that's the way this is packaged. And the reason I packaged it up in a sandbox solution was so that my end users can just drop this web part on a page. They don't have to wire it all together. And the whole thing is deployed all kind of in the same action of dropping it on the page. OK, so then I'm going to go into my application code. And what we have here is a bunch of JavaScript. And so this is this is kind of the skills change. And there's a lot of talks. I'll reference some of them later about HTML and JavaScript. And the way that we're starting to develop is more and more around these kinds of cross-platform JavaScript types of patterns. So what we're going to do here, here's the code that it calls initially. It says display the child sites. And what it's going to do is show that main div and hide the form from view. It's going to get the two SharePoint contexts, which in this case of 2010 are both going to be the same. This is the only thing that's different in 2013 version, other than the packaging, is that the host context would be created to use that cross-domain bridge. And then it's going to go ahead and get a list of webs from the client object model. So it's going to get the current web and then get the child sites by saying this.web.getwebs. And then it's going to load the web and it's going to load the child webs. But I'm basically saying this is what I kind of like about the client object model. You don't have to get any more data than you really need because you're now pulling that data over the wire. So you want to kind of be aware of that. I don't need every detail about those child sites. All I need is the title, the description, and the URL. So that's all I'm going to get. And at this point in the code where I have it highlighted, nothing has gone back to the server. No data has been retrieved from the server. And if I tried to use those objects, they would be empty. The reason is because the client object model batches your requests. And this is actually pretty cool. If you think about it, if I was to go to the grocery store, maybe I need milk and eggs and some cheese, right? So would I drive to the grocery store, get the milk, drive home, then drive to the grocery store and get the cheese, drive home, then drive to the grocery store again for the bread? No, I wouldn't. I would have a shopping list. I would write them all down, and I would make one trip to the store and come back with everything I needed to make supper. And that's what we're doing here. But we're basically, these lines of code up till now are essentially creating the shopping list for the client object model and saying, go to the server once and bring back all this data for me so I can put it on the page. It's only when we call execute query async that it's actually going to go ahead and pull this data in. Now, Another advantage of the client object model is that it was richer in SharePoint 2010 than the RESTful code was. So there was some amount of REST. RESTful calls are the other way you can access SharePoint 2013. There was a way to do it in SharePoint 2010. It really only allowed you to access list data. So this particular demo would not have been possible using REST. Once I've executed the query, I can come back successful, and I can walk through these objects and render out that table. So here's the table. Here's the enumerator. This is the way that you do it in JavaScript. I'm going to loop through using this web enumerator and list out all the sites and put them into a table object. So if that doesn't work, then I pop up a little message. Now, when I go to create the site, we're going to display the form. We're going to clear out all the input fields. And here's the code that creates a site. Very simple idea, similar idea. But the little trick here is that if I want to create the site from a custom web template, I have to get a list of web templates so I know the GUID that's inside the one I want to create. So this first little method here is going to get all the available web templates in English and load those up. And then once it gets that back, it can go ahead and create the site. So find the web template that I want and create the site. And it fills out this little thing called a web creation information object and creates the site. So, I just wanted to kind of give you a flavor for what the APIs look like. In managed code, this is even simpler, and it looks a little bit more like the server-side API. So now let's go on to the second example. And what this one does, this is an example. Now, this time I'm going to run the code on a web server. And the little trick that we're going to play is that in the SharePoint 2013 app, it's going to run outside of SharePoint in an external web server. In the SharePoint 2010 version, I'm still going to allow myself a farm solution because I don't really know where to host that code anyway. So I'm going to go ahead and I don't really know how to deal with security that much. So I'm going to go ahead and use a farm solution for this application on SharePoint 2010, but I'm doing a little trick, which is to use the client-side API on the SharePoint 2010 server. What that means is, again, I'm going to get close to 90% code reuse by following the app pattern and just packaging it in a farm solution, which I'll show you how that works towards the end, and it will actually allow me to get all the code reuse when I'm ready to go later to the app model. So this time I'd like to start by showing you the SharePoint 2013 version. And this is a little application that puts locations on a map. So maybe you have offices or different stores or something like that in your world, and you want to show those on a map. And another little cool thing here is it's going to allow me to show off, as an aside, a really cool SharePoint 2013 feature, which is the geocode column that allows me to actually show things geocoded on a map. So I'll go ahead and trust it. And the first thing it's going to want is my Bing Maps key, so I didn't feel like including that in the source code. So when the app comes up, the first thing it does is grab your Bing Maps key and sticks it into a site property inside of the app web. And then it creates this list. Now, this list is actually in the app web in the case of my SharePoint 2013 world. In SharePoint 2010, I only have one site, and it's just going to be in that site. So the exact same CAML code that creates the list is identical between the two solutions. Now, if I create a new item, and I'll just come in here and put in a location and type in an address. And what this is going to do is I have an event handler that's going to run whenever I change this list, that's going to geocode the item using Bing Maps API. So put in another location. Now, Mark Anderson asked me why I didn't do this a little bit differently. Instead of an event handler, I could have put client-side JavaScript code on this form and done the geocode right here. And the real answer is because I wanted to show an event handler. But you know, there are some things that can go wrong with that scenario. Like when you migrate to a new version of SharePoint, they might change the way the form works. So if I have a custom form, I might have to redo it. You know, who knows? I think that Mark's idea is a good one, though. Mainly, I wanted to show the event handler. So you'll see here that the little geolocation columns have showed up. And in fact, I can view a map of each location. And that works just fine. And this, by the way, will not work in 2010. So that is the geolocation column feature in 2013 is interesting because they've added this great field type, but they didn't really add any way to fill it in or to expose it in the user interface. So in my list definition, I actually had to go in and put in the code that said, you know, make this a geolocation column. And then my event handler is actually calling Bing Maps and is going to load that code into place. Another cool thing that, again, this is just sort of FYI because it doesn't work in the 2010 version, is this idea of a map view. So they went ahead and built this really cool map view that will display all the locations on a map right in the list. But again, we're not going to get that until we get to SharePoint 2013. However, the main point of the app was to put this right on the page. So I can go ahead and edit the page. And insert this right into my page. And there's my app. And then I can go ahead and edit the web part. And I'll talk a little bit more about this tomorrow. I've got a talk on MVC development in the same room at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And I'll show how these web parts work in that session and how you would pass information into them. But for now, you can see that I can change the look of the map very easily. Now, when I go to SharePoint 2010, the solution looks a lot the same, except for I'm in SharePoint 2010. So if I go to my locations list here, one difference you'll notice is that my geolocation column didn't exist. So I used a regular text column, and I serialized the geolocation information in JSON format. And so that's the only real difference in the code, and it did add a little bit, did take away a little bit from the reuse capability, but sort of factored my code around that. So same thing happens. I've got an event handler. This time it's a server-based event handler. And that got geocoded, and now I can come in and show all three points on the map. Pretty cool. So let's take a look at this one. So this one, again, we got over 80% code reuse. And while I'm talking here, I'm going to try to bring up the other code. So hang on for a second. OK, so basically, again, on the left, I've got my 2010 solution. On the right, I've got my 2013. And if you kind of analyze what's going on here, the geolocation field was something that was different. I had to create a little object called geolocation field. And in the SharePoint 2013 version, it uses the real geolocation field. In SharePoint 2010, I had to kind of simulate the geolocation field using a text field and some JSON serialization code, which I won't dig into. You can download the code if you want to see how that works. It's pretty straightforward, really. Now, if I go into my list, the list is the same for both. I have a site column there that was slightly different. So I had noted that actually as being a difference. The site column is defined as text for 2010 and as geolocation for 2013. Referencing that site column, the lists are the same. The HTML and CSS is the same. The list event is different. So this is just a little shim that runs server code on 2010 that's an event receiver. And in the case of SharePoint 2013, it's what they call a remote event receiver. So the way these work is that Visual Studio creates a web service endpoint for you. It creates a little WCF service which is here, and then SharePoint will call that web service when anything in the list changes. So that code obviously is different, and all that does is a very, very simple amount, it's a very small amount of code that calls my class that does the geocoding. I did as little as I could in that code because I knew it would have to be different, and then the code that does the geocoding and stuffs the geocoded value back into the list is actually written using client-side APIs and therefore is able to be completely common between the two solutions. Finally, the rendering of the, so the updating of the list is the same, and then the web part itself is the same as the first one we saw in that it's going to get the SharePoint context using that same little trick to read the geocodes out of the list, and then it displays the map. All that code is completely the same. So again, this got over 80% common code between the two versions, and what I'm finding is that in putting this into practice, the more complex your application, the more common code you get. So these are fairly simple examples, and we're getting between 80 and 90% code reuse between the two. But in Julie's example, she got over 95%. Why? Because her application did more, there was more common code. And this packaging code or this little bits of glue code to make it work one way or the other, it becomes a smaller percentage as you add more to the application. So let's see if we can take a quick look at this. I don't have a huge amount of time for it because I want to allow for another demo. I guess we're doing okay, actually. So again, this is the 2010 version. And what you can see here is here's that geolocation field. Actually, let's go into the event receiver. That's actually more interesting, probably. So this is the item added event and the item updated event. What's interesting is that the event receivers in the 2013 side are slightly different, but they're still in the way that you code them, but they're still a little bit funky in the way that you actually get the before and after properties. I don't know if you've ever written one of these, but the way that basically it gives you before and after properties of what happened before the event fired and what happens after the event fired. And you would think that it would be that simple, but in some cases you actually want to look inside the list item itself to see the values. So if either of these get called, it basically just calls get geocode, which is going to come in here and grab all the information out of the property bag, and then it's going to say using client context and bring up the client-side API and pass that client context into checklist item geocode. So what that allows me to do is from here on, I have 100% common code between the app model and the on-premises farm solution. Checking the geocode, it's just going to grab my Bing Maps key out of the grab the Bing Maps key. It's also going to build a query, so it's going to take the name, address, and or the city, state, et cetera, and put together a query. And then if that's not null, it's going to go ahead and get that Bing Maps key out of the property bag. Again, this is how you do it. I wanted to give you a flavor for what the client-side coding looked like in .NET. So you can see it's pretty simple stuff. I'm just going to load the properties and execute the query. It's not asynchronous, which makes my code much simpler to read. And then I get the Bing Maps key out of there. Then I go ahead and do the geolocation, which is a Bing Map, which is a call to the actual Bing Maps service. And then I'll go ahead and get the list and update the geolocation field inside of that list. And that's basically it. So really pretty simple stuff. And then on the web, on the web part itself, the way that I did that was, I remember in the case of, it's all client-side code. So in the case of SharePoint 2013, that's a page that's running behind an iframe. So that client web part that you get is actually just an iframe in SharePoint 2013. So what's the best way to do that in a farm solution in the old world? Well, it's to use a visual web part. So if we actually look at this web part, here's the web part, And the code that's on that runs this JavaScript to render the map is actually exactly the same, whether it's living in this client-side, in this visual web part, or if it's running outside of SharePoint in an app web, or sorry, in an external site that's going to show up in the web part. So it's going to load all the various scripts, and then app.js is actually going to go ahead and plot the map. So pretty straightforward. You can take a quick look at that. Here's where it goes through, gets the map type, shows the dashboard, passes in the credentials, and builds up this little call to Bing Maps, which is then going to loop through the locations from the list that have been placed on the page and put a push pin for each one, set the boundary of the map, and then set the map view. By the way, if you haven't played around with the Bing Maps API, it's just so much fun because it's very visual, and they have the only visual SDK that I've ever seen where you can go and play with maps, and then it'll give you the code to implement that in your code. So I definitely recommend checking that out. Is there a license for the Bing Maps? So we had a question over here. So T-shirt, please. Is there a license for the Bing Maps? Yes, and it is free. So it's free for most users anyway. So basically, you just have to sign up, and they'll give it to you for free. And it's available for some amount of commercial use. You'd have to read the fine print. I think if you're going to do incredibly large volume, they'll start to charge for it at some point. But it's basically you just go up to just do a Bing for Bing Maps and find the interactive SDK, and it'll give you all the steps to get the Bing Maps key and to go forward with that.
Excuse me.
Yes. I can't see the person because of the lights. Oh, yes, sir. No. So the question is the client side. There was an announcement here that there will be a way from the client side object model to create a site collection. And it might even be a RESTful call. I haven't had a chance to dig into it because they just announced it the other day. That is SharePoint 2013 only. So all of these patterns depend on your sort of living inside of the common denominator between 2010 and 2013. So we're fortunate that 2010 shipped with, you know, a pretty rich set of client object models that we can exploit in both platforms. So a question in the front. Yes. So the question is there a way to provision a list not in the app space but in the web space? Do you mean like in the host web?
Yes.
Okay. So yes, he means in the host web. So this is an interesting question. The answer is sort of. You can't provision it in the normal way of setting up a list instance in your code and deploying it. The app model won't let you do that. You can do what I call content injection. There might be a fancier name for that. But basically, you can write procedural code that uses the cross-domain bridge or uses OAuth to manually create that list. So you can use REST or client-side object model to say, please create a list. Now add a column, add a column, add a column. So you can do that on premises. That's probably a little bit more work, but a fine approach, in my opinion. Just FYI, the SharePoint, the Office Store will never approve that. So in order to do that, you'll need too much permission, and the Office Store so far has denied all requests that would have that much control. So it's sort of, I think they're trying to encourage people to put their content in the app web. And, you know, it brings up an interesting point, which is it bothered me a little bit when SharePoint 2013 came out that they called everything an app. And I thought, oh, my gosh, the marketing people have gone crazy again. Right, they did it with .NET. There was comm solutions that they called .NET back in the day, and now they're calling everything an app. What's going on here? When I actually worked with this solution, and I saw the pattern from a friend of just sort of the, you know, deploying an app and having a list inside the app, and the way that this is written is if you're in the SharePoint 2013 side, if you click on the app, once you've entered your Bing Maps key, it brings you right to the list, which is in the app web. And so it suddenly hit me. that end users are going to look at my app as if it was a list. They're not going to, it's just a magic list that has a web part that shows maps, right? So to the end user, the list and the app are the same. And so it actually made sense to me for the first time that they would call lists apps or let the two blur together. Because when you write an app, you have that opportunity to sort of present a list as the user interface or part of the user interface for your app. So great question.
So one last question here at the mic.
Okay.
Right in the middle.
Yes.
Okay. You can hear me.
I can
it's
hear
okay, you.
You
can. You can
someone,
see me.
Someone up in the clouds is asking.
Right.
This is not a cloud talk, but it's okay.
Yeah, so I just wanted to know that you had this remote event listener, which mm-hmm. is a WCF service. Where does this get deployed to? Like when you deploy, upload the app, where does it? This
okay,
has
so in the case of SharePoint 2010, it's a traditional event handler that runs right on the SharePoint server. I can see you now. In the case of SharePoint 2013, these provider-hosted apps are running in a site outside of SharePoint. So that if you checked off auto-hosted app, it would run in Windows Azure. But that's only available in Office 365 right now. So since this is an on-prem solution, let's assume that's not what you want to do. So you would go in, you would build a provider-hosted app, and you would take that website, that IIS website, and deploy it to a web server somewhere inside of your enterprise, and it would run there. So this is a little bit of a growing pain to me for the app model is that Microsoft has not yet given us an easy way to deploy these provider-hosted apps on-prem. And it's not rocket science, it's just an IIS site. But wouldn't it be nice, one of the nice things about SharePoint was you kind of set up SharePoint server and then you could just deploy as many solutions as you wanted and not have to install any more web servers. And now we're asking somebody to install a web server. So if anyone from Microsoft is listening, I have a feature request, which is please make something that's a lot like auto-hosted apps that works on-prem. Because I'd like to be able to just package it up. The auto-hosted apps are really cool, but they only work in Office 365 and Azure. It would take that entire website, package it up inside of your app file, and upload it, the SharePoint part to SharePoint Online, the Azure part to Azure, or the web server part to Azure, and you don't even have to worry about it. It just takes care of it.
Okay. So and in the Office 365 scenario, this service will get deployed to the Azure
correct.
Web server.
Correct.
And SharePoint takes care of it by itself.
That's right. SharePoint will take care of it. And cool. I'll talk about that again some more tomorrow morning at the MVC
Thank
talk.
You.
Thank you. Question here. And I think we might have run out of T-shirts, but the questions are still good. In 2010, where are you deploying the script? So in 2010, the scripts are being deployed. There's only one web, so they're being deployed into the same SharePoint site with the rest of the solution. And I'm just deploying them into a folder called scripts. So I'm just creating a, under the layouts directory, I'm just creating a folder. Or a document library. That would work fine. I could do a document library. In the first example that I showed with the dashboard, my colleague actually uploaded the scripts to a document library. So that will work fine. Actually, I don't remember if I was using layouts. I might have created a folder in the content system. But I think, you know, it doesn't really matter. You have a lot of flexibility. On
question
that.
Back of the mic.
Okay, I'll take one more question, then I'm going to move to the last demo.
Yes. Thanks. So basically, when you're talking about, you know, building apps with a future focus, one of the major things that was pushed, at least at the last conference, and we've been using heavily, is search. Everything is search-based, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you're developing apps like this, like provider hoster apps, just for a point of clarity, can that stuff get crawled properly and actually indexed in search, or is there anything special you need to do that way? Because that's sort of a major concern.
Well, the app, anything that's in the app web can be crawled because it's in SharePoint.
Okay.
If it's inside of your provider-hosted website that's outside of SharePoint, so you would have to find some other way of crawling that.
Right.
Certainly SharePoint is capable of crawling external websites, but I have to admit I haven't tried that. So you might have some security challenges there. You might have to create some other pages just for the purpose of crawling.
All right, thanks.
Sure. All right, so the last example, this one, as I mentioned before, is really just going to work for SharePoint 2013. But it's another example I wanted to include because it's cool and because it is another example of running your code outside of SharePoint. So maybe the scenario here is that you have SharePoint 2013 and you're still I'm still trying to kind of shift away from installing code on the server. So oftentimes we want to create custom workflow actions. SharePoint comes with a very nice workflow engine, SharePoint Designer, all this kind of stuff. And the problem is that it only has a limited number of actions. And if I want an action, if I want the workflow to do something that's not on that list, I have to code up a custom action. So the traditional way to do this has been to write C# code and to deploy it, either using a farm solution or in a sandbox solution. So I'd like to show you what's possible with the new workflow manager that shipped with SharePoint 2013 and how it's possible to call SharePoint's RESTful APIs from the workflow manager, again, repeating the same pattern of my code is running outside of SharePoint. The big difference, this one is going to look really different, though, because my code is running inside of workflow manager, and it's not even written in a procedural language, but it still works. So the next time you go to write, in fact, at Blue Metal, where I work, we've actually used this exact technique to create our sites, our SharePoint sites for our own use. So here's the scenario. I have another site creation scenario. This happens all the time. People want to create sites, and yet I don't want them to go completely crazy. I want to have some kind of a workflow. So in order to request a site, I come in here and I fill in a little form. And I will give the site a name and a little description and a short name. I'll call out to Ed Hild, who's the site creation master of the universe. He's here today and actually got me started on this theme as well. So now what's going to happen is you can see, if you look over here on the side, my workflow is running, and you can see my hopelessly old version of Outlook Web Access because I'm not an Exchange guy, so I apologize for that. I'm going to get a request to review my site. And let's go ahead and take a look at that. It brings me in here. I'm going to approve the site request. And now if I go back to my list and refresh it a few times, the workflow is eventually going to run. And it will eventually create the site. Once it's created the site, I'll see the listing here on the home page. Of course, this is a SharePoint Conference Party Finder, which is very, very important. And here is my child site that has been created. So how did this work? Well, to see how this would work, I actually come into SharePoint Designer. And SharePoint Designer has these workflows. So I'll go ahead and create a workflow. And here's the Create Site workflow. And notice that this is set to automatically start when an item is created inside of that list. So now if I edit the workflow, you'll see that it looks kind of like a SharePoint workflow, except for I have this special thing here called an app step. Now in SharePoint 2010 workflows, if I wanted to run with more privileges, right, my workflows would generally run under the user's credentials. But one of the things I want to do here is get away from this idea of run with elevated privileges, which sort of gives me omnipotent control over everything. And in SharePoint 2010 type workflows, they had this thing called an impersonation step that you could use. So this one step would run under the person, under the identity of the person who created the workflow. In SharePoint 2013, they've upgraded this to be an app step. So it's using these app permissions, even though this is not an app. Workflow itself actually runs as an app. Workflow itself has, the SharePoint 2013 workflow engine has an app identity that we've given permission to the site collection so that it can create these sites. And when I actually want to create the site, and you'll notice here that it says, there's a sentence, create site for project with a certain name and description. That's going to run inside the app step, which means it's going to run under the privileges of the app, of the workflow app. Now this is pretty nice, except for, and you'll notice that this create site for project was not part of SharePoint Designer. That's something that I added, and that's what I'm going to show you how to add. But you know, SharePoint Designer is cool, but it's much cooler in the new version where I can switch to Visio mode and view the whole thing in Visio right here inside of SharePoint Designer. And so again, here's the same workflow that I had before. I request the approval. I come in here inside of the app step. I create the site. then I'm going to get the site URL and send an email off to the user telling them that the site has been created and update the site listing. And if there was a problem, if it failed for some reason, or sorry, if it wasn't approved, then I'm going to send a different kind of sorry Charlie type of email out that their site wasn't approved. So that's the SharePoint Designer experience. And you'll notice, by the way, that those arguments that I passed in that sentence are available here too. So I can just come in here and edit those. It's just a little bit more visual instead of doing it in sort of an Outlook rule kind of a view. So to make this work, I have to create an XML file, which gets deployed into my SharePoint site using, ironically, this type of solution has one foot in the sandbox and one foot in workflow manager. The part that's in the sandbox doesn't have any code running, so it's not the part of the sandbox that was deprecated. It's just declaratively going to deploy this file with a rule designer action in it. So the action is here, and it says, you know, create site for a certain project with a description and a URL ending in. And then below that, so that's the sentence that the user sees. And then below that, I've got the fields that are going to be passed in, and then that bind basically to the sentence. And then the parameters that are going to get passed into my custom site action, my site creation action, and I get to say whether they're in or outbound parameters. In this case, they're all inbound. Sometimes I like to have an outbound parameter that gives me any exceptions that got thrown inside of the action. And then what data type they are and that sort of thing. So that's the declaration of it. Then I went into Visual Studio and created this workflow. So in Workflow Manager, you can only run workflows. So there's no place to put C# or Visual Basic code. So the actual create site action is a little baby workflow that's going to run inside of that other workflow. And so what it's going to do is it's going to do a sequence of actions, and it's going to build a RESTful web service call and then call SharePoint's RESTful APIs to create the site. So first it's going to build the request header. And actually, before I do that, I'll show you that the parameters are going to get passed in. So here's the site name, description, and URL that we passed in from before. And so you'll notice the tabs down at the bottom. There's a tab for variables and one for arguments. So the arguments here have to match. The names have to match. The names, directions, and types have to match what they were in that rules designer. And then that's going to provide those to my workflow. So then my workflow, once again, is going to build a request header and request metadata and a request body. And then inside of that request body is where I'm going to plug all the information that API call needed to do the RESTful site creation. So it's going to pass in the URL, the title, the description, the language, the site template, and then pass in some more parameters. Get site URL basically just does a little bit of string manipulation to build the URL. And then the create site action is this one wonderful little action that's sort of the ultimate extensible action, which calls a RESTful web service from inside of the workflow. So by doing this, I'm able to actually create the entire site and using the SharePoint API, and yet all the logic, if I don't know if I can call it code or not, but all the logic to create this is actually running outside of SharePoint. So this just sort of, as a little bit of a review, shows kind of the structure that was used here. And you can see here that the SharePoint 2013 actually ships with two workflow engines. So you've got the SharePoint 2010 workflow engine is still there for backward compatibility. In order to make this work, you have to install the new workflow manager, which runs outside of SharePoint. You can put it on the same servers as SharePoint if you want to. But you can also run it in a separate server farm. And then what's happening here is SharePoint's calling into the workflow engine, and then the workflow engine is calling into the RESTful services. There's also a provision for the new workflow manager to call the old workflow manager. So if you had some logic in the old workflow manager that you wanted to reuse, you could still do that as well. So in summary, Microsoft really moved the cheese on the way that us developers do our work. Used to be that we would run our code in the servers, and now they're asking us to adopt this new app model where all the code runs outside of SharePoint. The concept that I'm trying to get across today is that if you start running your code outside of SharePoint now, you can still use the old packaging with the new coding style and the new pattern, and you're going to be a whole lot closer to the goal when you're ready to move over to the new app model. So I hope this is helpful to you. There's some related sessions, so you'll need a time machine of some sort for this first one, but this morning we had complex problem solving with new HTML5 APIs. Definitely learning HTML and JavaScript development is key to being successful here, so you'll have to watch the recording of that. That was by Scott Hillier. Scott's also doing a session on third-party JavaScript libraries, and also earlier today, there was a session on TypeScript, so those may be helpful to you in gathering all this material. And then here's some resources and call to action. So basically, I would say prepare for the future. Start developing now outside of SharePoint so that you're ready to move to the new app model. And even before you do, you're going to get the advantages of stability and easier upgrade to your SharePoint platform by not having to run inside of the SharePoint process. It's time for us all to update our development skills. And this is a good thing. This is what the rest of the non-SharePoint developers out there have been using increasingly as well. Client-side development with JavaScript, jQuery, Knockout.js, the client object model, RESTful services. Learn the new app design patterns. Learn Azure and OAuth. And develop more in the browser, less on the server. Favor the client APIs over the server APIs. Now, I provided some resources here. There's a set of blog articles. So there's an architectural overview, then the SharePoint-hosted site creation example, followed by the provider-hosted locations example. Each one comes with a full blog article explaining the code, how it works, and a pointer to the code download. And then the workflow, I don't have written up yet. I'm working on it. But I will point you to the a blog article that inspired me. If Roger Erickson is here, please come back up at the end. There's a guy named Roger Erickson who lives in the Netherlands who wrote this awesome walkthrough on how to do the site creation with REST. And I sort of extended that to do to make it into a reusable workflow action for this talk. So I'm actually in the process of writing that up. But you can get a lot of that information out of that original article. And so that's basically it. I thank you for coming. We're going to do the drawing now. So Sadie, come on up. And I again, thank you all for attending. I hope it was useful. OK, sure. So Jonathan's going to draw the name.
This person is from Texas Women's University, Armin Rashid.
Congratulations. Okay, a nice new Dell venue. I think you'll love it. It's really a lot of fun. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Please remember to fill out the evals if you liked the session. If you didn't like the session, just have a nice day, and thanks for coming. We'll talk to you later.